James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
This is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good.
Any questions before we proceed?
Get drunk up. 6, 5, 4, 2, 1.
You live in a restricted broadcast area. You live in a restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You now, all that's left is the truth. Ask Guy James.
Oh, you better believe it. All the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth for you today, James Show, as we do every day. Welcome, and some sandy beaches of Southwest Florida, Naples, Fort Myers. I had to be with you today. I betcha. And I couldn't wait to say that. I betcha. Golly gee, and I can't help it. It's just, I'm just all bubbly since Sarah Palin's entered, you know, just puts me in a good mood every time I hear her not. It's getting to be when I hear the woman, and I'm sorry, here I go, just starting off again. Fingernails on a blackboard or all that is much more mellow sounding than her voice. Oh my God, I just can't stand it. I cannot stand it. But anyway, I promise I won't say anything else about Sarah Palin the rest of the show, although I want you to know I have my fingers crossing behind my back. awfully good to have you with us. I spend the whole weekend as much of it I can. I shouldn't say it that way. Saturdays after around 4 o'clock is the one time of the week that I get to just relax and enjoy myself. And I watch college football, and I love college football, and I usually go to sleep Saturday night with the TV still on, watch all. I even watched a game the other night with I watched my beloved Buckeyes, and that was like why this week, although they did win. And of course, the Michigan Mighty Toledo University, and of course I know Bob has had West Virginia Mountaineers won, so that's what I do for enjoyment on Saturday evening and all that. And, I went to the doctor yesterday. I've got like, a little dark spot on my cheek that's been getting, you know, it's not a mole or anything like that. I don't know if it's an H spot or what. But I go to the doctor yesterday. The doctor says, yeah, I said, I can take care of that. And I'm going away next week. By the way, I will not be here live next week because I'm going to be trapped. So I thought, well, I want to get that spot taken care of. So I'm at the doctor yesterday. Why am I telling you this? I'm at the doctor yesterday. He says, sure, I can take care of that. Let me get this liquid nitrogen out and tomorrow. Well, yeah. And another little spot on me, and now I got these real dark spots on my... If I had a webcam here, I'd show you. But now I'm going to go away this week. Am I going to look like a leopard here? Or... I don't know why I'm telling you this. Good to have all of you along. News from Florida. Charlie Crist, our governor who can't... Let me clarify that. He can't decide what he wants to be in the middle or Republican or Democrat. But, you know, when his name was being mentioned for being the VP of John McNasty, well, he was right in there pitching, and he was right in there pitching for a little while afterwards, and it seemed like Charlie hasn't shown up at all the events in Florida, and actually he was up until last week. In fact, he was at this one not far from here called Alico Arena, where our skinhead sheriff made an ass of himself. And by the way, he made such an ass, overwhelmingly, in Lee County, Florida, as a sheriff. That gives you an idea what it's like here. But Charlie was there. But Charlie, a lot of people are kind of bailing off the McCain right now, kind of like the rats getting off of a sinking ship, if you know what I mean, and this sinking ship. I think we'll all agree on that is a sinking ship, and barring some kind of a free roll or whatever, Mr. McCain is going to go down in defeat and go down in defeat. But Mr. McCain here in Florida the other day, and Charlie Crist was going to be there. Originally, he was scheduled to be there. He had to go to Disney World instead, and I'm not kidding. He went instead, and they asked him about, well, Charlie, are you going to be campaigning for or not? And he says, well, I will if I have time. That doesn't sound very enthusiastic to me, does it to you? I will if I have to. Mm-hmm. Yeah, along with Bill Kristol and Tommy Thompson and Romney and a host of others, they're all jumping off the ship. And Billy Kristol wants the McPalin ticket to go back to being themselves, he says. Hell, they are being themselves, Bill. But they're the selves that they've exhibited for years. They are nasty, mean-spirited, conniving individuals who absolutely lust for power and misuse it when they get it. And McCain proved his untrustworthiness with Charles Keating and years ago, and McPalin has proven it in many different respects, and they're all starting to come out. And I'll bet you Sarah didn't really enjoy the welcome that she got by the Philadelphia Flyers the other night. By golly, I'll bet she didn't. No. Like that one little bit, I would say. And Sarah also, what they're thinking, but these people are so unashamed, what's the word I'm looking for? Morally bankrupt. And they are. He takes what should have been a rock to the side of the head the other, and he came out about this Troopergate thing. As well, you know, I'm really glad that I've been absolved of any wrongdoing or anything legally wrong or any ethics violation. Wait a minute. You said you've been absolved of any problem with ethics violation? Did it not say that specifically in this report? That you were, in fact, guilty of ethics violations. Now, it's not an impeachable offense in Alaska. It's not something that they're going to get her thrown out of office for. But she lied about it. She knew damn well her husband was exerting pressure on the state to try and get rid of this brother-in-law of hers. She knew that. And, you know, I don't have a big problem with that. If she really intrigued, she wanted to use a little leverage that she has about it. Well, politicians do, and I know they do it. They do it on both sides of the aisle. There's very few of them that don't now and then. And although it was wrong, I'm not going to sit here and be hypocritical and say, oh, my God, that's the worst thing that ever happened, Ed, because it isn't. And I know many politicians have done many things wrong, and you hear me talk about them here on both sides of the aisle, and I'm going to get to that in a moment. Another just a moment. So I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, God, and what a terrible thing that was. That's not the fact is that what's wrong with this is, once again, is stir up. I am convinced to this day that if Richard Nixon would have stepped out in front of the American public and said, you know what? Some of my underlings got carried away, did a little political espionage, got caught, and all this. I'm sorry. I humbly apologize. I am so sorry that this happened. They got carried away with their enthusiasm, and, you know, G. Gordon Liddy's a rat, and I now know it. If Nixon would have done that, I almost think the Republican, the American people would have said, well, all right, we don't like this. we don't like this, but all right. But no, they got to go ahead and bowl their way through it. And, McPalin, Sarah Palin lied about this. It's obvious she lied through her teeth. Her husband lied. Everybody in Alaska knows they lied about it. If you're caught, give it up. Just if you're caught, plead insanity, plead ignorance, that's the thing. Now we know that, be trying to use a little influence, that she cannot be trusted on anything. It's just like, you know, back when he wrote his book, he said that he'd made a big mistake in the eating five. Now he has completed that he ever said that he was contrite about that, and all now it's something different. But they are jumping off the ship, and the campaign has been getting uglier every day, despite the fact that Mr. McCain has tried to put things right. I don't know if he's really so much tried to put things right. It's just the fact that he wanted to take away a little of the sting to his own campaign, because the public has gotten wise to his 100% negative ads. They have gotten wise to the fact that he sent this woman from Alaska, this political, I don't know what to call her. I don't know what to call the woman. I don't know that I've got a good for it. She's conniving. She knows how to play a political game in spades. She knows how to stand up there and lie, be convincing about it, and smile and nod and be so nice and that. And on the other hand, on some things, she's absolutely clueless. Clueless. So I can't think of any words to really describe her. Found a little audio cut here. John Cleese. You know, you remember John Cleese. Yeah. I'll let him explain it.
I used to think Michael fascinates me, though, is how people watching her may not see that she's basically learned certain speeches. And she does them very well. She's got a very good memory. But it's like a nice-looking parrot. Because the parrot speaks beautifully and kind of says, "Oh, shucks," every now and again, but doesn't really have any understanding of the meaning of the words that it is producing, even though it's producing them very accurately. And she's been in these training sessions with Cheney's pals, and she's learned these speeches. And the extraordinary thing is that so many people are taken in by it. And the truth is that Sarah Palin is no way good enough. And if you lined up from Europe, left-wingers, centrists, right-wingers, you wouldn't find 10 cent who think she's good enough to run the United States. And she's a 72-year-old cancer survivor. I mean, Monty Python. And I'm sorry, Michael Palin, to say it anymore, but you're not.
John Cleese, I thought he was tremendously funny. It's always liked everything that I think he ever did. I find him absolutely human. He kind of sums it up for me on Sarah Palin, so I'll try not too much to talk about it anymore today, but know that, of course, John has said now that he's got us right where he wants us, right? Yeah, he wants us. And these ugly mobs now, a lot of their campaign mobs. And that's exactly what they are. And I think last time we were together, I think I played you a little bit of a ugly mob, but where do I have this here? Maybe I don't have it. I thought I did. It's just it's very upsetting, some of the things these people in these lines. Here we go. Some more McCain Palin crazy people, and that takes in just about everybody waiting in lines to see Sarah Palin or John McCain. It is amazing to watch independent or biased, it doesn't matter, reporters go down those, ask them. They're not singling people out, mind you. They're just going down the line, indiscriminately picking people out and saying, "What do you think?" And answers.
And one thing we know Barack Obama. He's a lawyer.
I think you're stupid.
Why, sir?
Because that guy gets elected, he hangs around with terrorists.
Who's the terrorist?
Obama.
Yeah. Obama's a terrorist, don't you know that?
Obama's a Muslim, he's a terrorist himself.
Do you really believe that, sir? Do you really believe that? You believe that Senator Obama is a terrorist?
I believe he supports terrorism.
Here it is! Love it!
That's me, Ryan!
Comedy faggot! Comedy faggot!
A terrorist.
Go home!
Go get a job!
Go get a job!
Get a job!
Job!
Nice.
Swine.
You're going to go to Russia.
Screw Obama. Boo. Cowboys. Europeans.
You think they
spill airs, sir?
You think they should die?
Everyone dies, don't they?
And then you kill babies. From abortion! He can't protect the most.
He was voted that way to make their own rape kit. My friend shouldn't have to pay for their own rape kit. How do you feel about that?
Rape kit.
Rape
kit.
Oh, you are horrible.
I'm horrible.
And he is a Muslim. So is Senator Obama an American too?
I don't know what he is.
God bless America.
Let's register more dead people for Obama.
I think that Acorn is the sleaziest, most despicable, corrupt, good friend of our friend Barack. Sleazy scum of the earth.
Can you be more specific?
Yeah, I can be
specific. What have they done?
What have they done? Them and their Obama have single-handedly brought this catastrophe on our country through their dealings with Fannie Mae. Barack Obama, the second most paid person from Acorn, who registers dead people state to state. Where do I stop?
We're on the sidewalk to nowhere.
Yeah. There is your average crowd at your... I've gotten myself to the point I can't say their names properly. Acorn rallies. Those are the people that you run into. And I don't know what to say other than, wow. Are McCain and Palin responsible for these ugly mobs? Yes, of course they are. They're now, you know, their campaign people are coming out and saying, well, they can't be responsible for an occasional crazy in the mob. They're not responsible for that. They are responsible for this ugliness. They're out there every day with inflammatory speeches. But the one thing we all have to remember is that extremism has been and always will be present in the political arena. This is nothing new. Republicans, do remember that it was Barry Goldwater. Defense of liberty is no vice. That was one of his. Now, oddly enough, many people looked at him as extreme, but he was very much a moderate compared to the con Republicans, your average Republican. And in the study of psychology, you're going to find that if you have a group of people who all share the same political beliefs, that they will ultimately become extreme because they won't hear anything but their and those around them that have the same beliefs. Always right, no matter what. If you're with somebody that believes, and everybody around you believes 2 and 2 is 5, and you sort that back and forth from one to another, convinced that 2 and 2 is 5. And so when you get people that have the same political beliefs, they're ultimately going to become extreme because they won't hear anything but their own beliefs, making them believe that they're right no matter what. And then, therefore, they become even more extreme. And we have to consider the fact that if you have a group that's extreme, there'll be sort of a contest for leadership. And those that are seeking the leadership roles are kind of going to see it as an advantage to be just a little bit more extreme than the rest of them. And that, to themselves at least, and maybe a better neocon than the rest, more so if they're a little more extreme. You aren't just any radical neocon, you're the pack leader. And it's not just Republicans who have this problem. The fringes on both sides are vulnerable to them. The only thing is that so far in this the Democratic candidates have, to their great credit, have from coming out of the woodwork. And it's that simple. The Republicans, the McPalin-McCain kind of behavior at their rallies, they have not put it down. And fortunately, we have no reports of anything rally, but I can tell you this much, and you know this to be true. If Barack Obama were standing in front of the stage and somebody said, yep, you can bet Barack Obama would stop that person in their tracks and admonish them for saying such a horrible thing. You can bet that's what would happen. The Democratic candidates have in my opinion, they've remained cool, calm, and rational. While this Republican ticket has gone out and preached hatred and divisiveness, and that's the difference. And I'm afraid some of this gets us to the point where we can't put the genie back in the bottle. I'm afraid that the hate that is being preached right now, and the hate you just heard from these lines of people waiting to get in rallies, that kind of hatred is dangerous to our way of life. It is not. In fact, it is the antithesis of they're so American. They were singing God Bless. How can you sit there and sing God Bless America when a little bit before someone yelled, how can you sing God Bless America and claim to be a patriot and right when you're standing there saying the opposite side is a terrorist and a Muslim and all that they make? How can you do that? First of all, by behavior, you're exposing your ignorance. And the average IQ, I'd hate to say these McCain-Palin rallies really is. I'm sorry, but I've seen half a dozen videos now taken down along these lines. And I have to tell you, I'm not impressed with the intelligence that we're seeing. Not impressed at all. And then you've got McCain on the tube telling us that, oh, they're saying bad things about me at the Obama rallies, too. First of all, has he been to an Obama rally? I can tell you this. I have not heard a single report of someone yelling out, kill him, at an Obama or a Biden rally. Have you? If you have, let me know. And if you have it, let me know. But I have not. And I had the pain of had to endure listening a little bit of Hannity because it was on the lookout for something I knew. Is there any more of a hate monger anywhere than this little clown Hannity? Is there a worse one than him? I've gotten, and I'm not kidding about this, I've gotten so that if anyone says to me of Sean Hannity that they listen to him, believe him, and they like his beliefs and his thoughts, I can't talk to you. I won't talk to you. Worth a moment of my time. And I have done so. I have. It's not even rude. It's not rude at all. If someone tell me they're a fan of Sean Hannity and they believe his crazy beliefs, his absolutely bold speech that he comes across with every day, and at least more of an entertainer, Hannity lives and breathes the hatred. You can hear the hatred in his voice, and he's done everything he can to stir up as much of it as possible. So, I'm not kidding. When someone tells me that they're a Hannity disciple, you're a great American, Sean, I have the greatest contempt for that person. It's not one of these things where I say, well, we've got to agree to disagree. No, that's where the line is drawn. We can agree to disagree on many different things, but we cannot treat you like a hate monger like Sean Hannity. have tried to get a response from him. I have tried to get a word from him, anything about his yelling fire in a crowded theater, and that is exactly what he's doing. So there's no word from any of them ever. He is a despicable human being. I very much regret when I was at the Democratic National proximity to him the entire time I was there. Last hours, I very much respect just not starting one with him out in the hall. Didn't want to be running the campaign, but I would like to have started a real verbal Donnybrook with the likes of Sean Hannity. You know he can't stand. He was only with his radical, crazy neocon. But I guess I talked too much about him, but it's an ugly thing. Very ugly thing. And I think these people have fostered hatred. A couple of interesting things. First of all, in the interest of fairness, and I hope that I am nothing if not fair on this program, I do try and always point out the good things and bad things about both sides. Tim Mahoney, Democratic congressman, took the place of a Republican here in Florida, had all these ads about what a great family man I am. Now we find that he's paid to meet a former mistress who worked on his staff and was threatened to sue him. According to the current and former members of his staff who've been in his campaign committee, poor Bob Graham was out there stumping for him to get him elected. $1,000, Mahoney made this payoff to come out and say, you know, admit it. He should have known he was going to get exposed anyway. Bruh. I thought about Republican ethics problem. And I feel the need to report on this, a payoff like this, and Mahoney needs to go. He needs right now. When his predecessor was in, at least he had the good sense to get out. Mark Foley, I'm talking about. He had the good sense to get out. They pretty much forced him out. The Republicans did. They went and told him to his face, we will not back you anymore. We would just as soon you get the hell out of the Congress of the United States. And he did. Give him credit for that. They tried to cover it up a bit first, and then finally when the truth was going to come out, that was it. And I'm not just saying this, a huge majority in the House, with or without Mahoney, there is no room for payoffs going on of $121,000. Sexual harassment is what it was over. And hush money. There's no plain and simple. And while I'm at it, I think Nancy Pelosi should get on the Capitol steps and say that William Jefferson isn't worthy of democratic values either. Make examples of these people. That's absolutely what should be done. Make examples of them. Have no sympathy for them. Speaking of having no sympathy, I hear John McCain is going to bring up the William Ayers affair. He has told many people that he's going to bring it up tomorrow night at the debate. I welcome that. The idea that Obama will stand there and tell you the truth about what happened. What is involved? Convince the American people there was nothing untoward on his part whatsoever. And I love the that John McCain has been using over and over and over. And it goes something like this, paraphrasing, I done honesty and ethics and morals, and if I had, I wouldn't ask a Democratic politician from... Well, maybe you just ought to ask, John. Because I'm convinced, and time will tell, that the little note I'm about to read you could never have been written by Barack Obama. In 1986, John McCain wrote a political memo ago. I know it, but it still speaks to the character of this man. In 1986, John McCain wrote a political note on official House of Representatives stationery. apologizing to Charles Keating Jr. for his campaign having listed his good friend and supporter as part of McCain's Senate Campaign Finance Committee. And Keating responded with a handwritten note addressed to Senator 7 months before McCain won his seat, telling him not to sweat it. And Keating says, don't be... You can call me any, write anything, or do anything. I'm yours till death. Isn't that just precious? Find me a note like that about John, about Barack Obama. And I will seriously listen to what you have to say tomorrow night. You do, in fact, have the guts to bring up William Ayer's story. We're going to pause for a break here on the Guy James Show, 866-546-5252.
You don't clean up your room, the Board of Health.
Board of Health doesn't even know about your room. What's more, don't care.
You know, if you keep making that face, it's going to...
So you're someplace really, really cold. Actually, a lot of the warnings moms hand out are a bit exaggerated.
If you don't get your blood pressure checked, you could have high blood pressure, not even know it, and you could die from a stroke.
But she's right about that one. Fact is, high blood pressure contributes to 200,000 American deaths each year. And a third of those who have high blood pressure don't know it. If they did, it'd be simple to treat. Call the American Heart Association at 1-800-AHA-USA1 or visit AmericanHeart.org on the web to learn more. Better still, ask your doctor to check your blood pressure.
If you run...
Best you can do.
I'm not afraid to die.
there, Head Game Show. Thank you for being with us this afternoon. Always, we've got a good audience this afternoon. That pleases me. Thank you. 866-546-5254. I see Rick Sanchez on me an email that the McCain campaign is livid with CNN for exposing Palin's relationship with the Alaskan Independent Party, and they showed the video of Sarah addressing the group's last convention. What, they just now getting around to that? What, we, 3 days after Sarah Palin was nominated? Is that news? CNN is furthering the smear? Why? I can't get over that. That is news. It has been out there for some time. We certainly talked about it on this program. We certainly immediately played you the audio of Sarah Palin congratulating the convention, told him to keep up the good work and all that. I don't see where this all of a sudden is news. We had that within 3 or 4 days after she was named. So, I don't know, first of all, I don't know why CNN is now, unless it is to incite the campaign to come questions about it, that would be a good thing. And really, I'm finding it something that the McCain campaign, we know that the chairman of the AIP had talked about first dude being a member of the AIP for quite a while. We know that he mentioned that Sarah Palin herself had been very supportive of. At first, it had been reported that she had been a member of the AIP, but we do know that her husband was, and she, I heard from her very words, that she's been very supportive of the AIP party as the group started by this radical, can't think of his name, who called for the secession of Alaska. The United States of America. Remember America First? You remember that? America First? Yeah. Well, yeah, America First. Her husband was a diehard member of that group, and she always wishes them well and talks to their convention each year that she's been the governor and wished them well. This is a group who wants to secede from the United States of America. Yeah, that's America First, all right. Yeah. Those are the kind of organizations, and when we talk about the state of Alaska, and when she said that Alaska is no more than a microcosm of the rest of the country, they've got a lot of places up. Know what I'm talking about? Groups that sympathize the AIP, the kind of goings on that the AIP is. So for the campaign now of Obama, or I mean Palin-McCain campaign, to be upset about this now. Very common knowledge. Well, it's common knowledge to you and I. I will say that the American public has not been exposed to it all that much. Maybe that's what very few people know this story. Times I delude myself by saying, well, hell, everybody knows about this. Well, you know it. You keep up with things. My audience knows it. People here on the hood, because we bring up these things. In fact, many, many times, in reporting things like that. We're right there at sometimes the major networks catch on a day or two later. And you will listen to Bob, listen to Mark, listen to my show, you will find it many times. You won't hear what we're talking about on the mainstream media, on MSNB or CEC or CNN or those until 2 or 3 days later. And I'm not bragging, I'm just telling you that's how it is. Well, and, you know, the story has come up this past couple of days about the same contractor involved in building that big weight around the city of Wasilla's Neck, a huge skating rink that she decided they had to have up there that's losing. Seems some supplied the building supplies for that also, maybe did supply the building supplies for her house, her $500,000 house that's on a lake. We don't know. We do know that Todd Palin said that he and some of his buddies just a lot of interesting things that went on with that. Palin got building permits eliminated in Wasilla. That's a wide-open town, Wasilla. I've been there. It was much smaller than it is now. It was pretty bump in the road. Can't remember if they had stoplights then, but they did away with no record about who did the actual building, what condo and people involved. There's none of that. They do have completion permits there. Once the house is completed, they have to report that. So there's all this mystery surrounding her house now. A lot of mystery surrounding her house. Did Todd Palin build that house? Also, of course, we know that the people that supplied the building materials for the skating rink and her house were big sponsors of Todd Palin's racing, his snowmobile racing. Why do they call it snow machine racing up there? Is a snow machine different than a snowmobile? Anyway, he sponsored Todd Palin, this supplier did, and will not come out unequivocally and say, in building that house, he's just saying, well, gee, I really don't know. I don't know. And, of course, this same builder, I might name a supplier, building supply person, supplied Stevens house. This is getting in it. So, I apologize. The McCain-Palin campaign appears to have a problem. Even if they, if we found out somebody built that house for them gratis and gave it to them and violated every law, denied any culpability in this problem and the other, well, I'm glad I've been cleared from everything, that I didn't do anything more legally or ethically wrong. Although it says quite plain and simply that she did in the report. So, I don't know if this will end up being anything. Will it end up being a big kickback story? If it'll end up being anything at all? Who knows? But as it comes out, we'll report it. We weren't first on that story, but we have been first on some other ones. 866-546-5254. Did you hear about Rush Limbaugh, Mr. OxyContin himself, the drug-addled right-wing talk show host? Mr. Truthful Rush Limbaugh. I wonder, I've never had any OxyContin. Have you? Does it really scramble your head that much? If it is a pink? And he was supposedly taking it because he had a bad back, something or other, and it turns out he was taking like a handful of them in a day's time, like one every 8 hours from what I know, OxyContin. Sounds like on OxyContin, because there's this before his criminal act was exposed. I think most everybody in Ball Show knew that there was something seriously wrong with him, his slurring of his speech, and covered that up and all. Sounds odd. And do you know, I didn't know this, and long ago, I actually heard him admit it. He has those cochlear ear implants in his skull to help him hear, but he still can't hear really a regular conversation. He's still, for all intents and purposes, legally deaf. Didn't know that. So it's meaningless to have a conversation with him, I guess, at a dinner table, because he can't really hear you. But anyway, what I want to go on, he got in this little Donnybrook with Mary Mitchell, a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. And so, Limbaugh yesterday, well, let me back up. Let me set this up for you. A columnist, Mary Mitchell, called out Sarah Palin for inciting hate, just like we've been talking about earlier in the program, and she got quite an angry response for today. And quoting Limbaugh here, he says, Mary Mitchell, a wimp columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Boy, isn't that something? Rush Limbaugh, son's a wimp. Pot calling. Says that Sarah Palin should be censured. She says that Sarah Palin Obama campaign and the American people for her role in bringing out the worst supporters. This is laughable, says Rush. Well, this is the big leagues. How about the people in your party? I know you're all you liberal media people are Democrats. What about the incitement of this whole country that you and your friends have engaged in along with the Democrat Party? You have gendered up hate for this president. You've ginned up a despise for the U.S. military. You have sought to convince the American people their country is worthless and sinking into the abyss. You've been doing it for 6 years. Limbaugh also called Mitchell a racist nutball. So, I don't think old Rushy Boy, drugs or not, I don't think Rush knew that Mary Mitchell is not about to wimp out, not about to cave in to anything he has to say. And so she responded to him, and I love her response. She said, when you step on a pig's tail, it squeals. Why is he squealing? Because John McCain and Sarah Palin found in a contest that they thought was theirs. And they're losing it. Of course, Limbaugh won't say that. Instead, on his time berating me for saying Palin needs to apologize for inciting crowds. But that's at black members of the press. A wimp columnist, Limbaugh says, she says. So why would a multi-million dollar on-air time on a wuss and a wimp? The reason Limbaugh is squealing like a pig, the pig he is because he's the privilege. He can't wrap his small mind around the fact that Barack Obama is kicking McCain's butt in the polls. And to make matters, a black woman ask a white woman who's on it to apologize for the inappropriate behavior of her supporters. Mitchell says, whenever a crowd gets whipped up to the point that they turn ugly and start hurling racist insult, it is common sense that the candidate moves to rein it in, but McCain is so desperate to win, he's feeding off those angry crowds. Come on. The squealer, meaning Limbaugh, was among the first to demand that Barack Obama denounced his former pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, for comments deemed offensive to white people. I repeat, had Obama fans acted a fool the way the McCain fan did, every pundit, with the squealer leading the way, would have demanded he offer some kind of apology. So Mitchell says, I'm the racist nutball, but the squealer is the one who made it at every opportunity. But I have a voice too, and all of Limbaugh's bluster and all the calls of his rabid false me when bigoted bullies are running amok and I'm not running for vice president. Limbaugh's sorry ass Palin wants to spend his time trying to bully me, as they say in my bring it. This from Mary Mitchell. Columnines and Mary, bully for you. Limbaugh should have known. She's in. I see the market right now is down something like that. It has been down as much as 250. It has been up as much as at least 250 or 60. Another odd day. I guess the bulls were running wild yesterday and they had to take a breather today. Plan on talking when we come back from the break at the top of the hour. We're probably going to discuss the electoral map as it sits right now. And believe me, I enjoy looking at the electoral map right now. It's a thing of beauty. And we'll go over that when we come back. If you'd like to join us here, give us a call, 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. We'd like Hilo back to the chat room. By the way, all of you listening, be sure and head on over to the Head on our chat room. All you got to do is sign in. Just takes a moment or so. Your personal information or anything. I'll just give you a pattern, and you need to do that. Join this crowd. We got quite a crowd on there today. I know that this group in the chat, they're very, very educated people in the political scene. Know very well what in the political scene. 866-546-5250. And I agree with Bedtime for Bonzo, said ignore the market since it's a nest of field mice when you lift a hay bale. Some run up. Very true. We'll talk a little bit about the market when we come back. It's nothing more than a Las Vegas style. Well, let's put it this way. All the regular people who buy stock are the gamblers. And the bankers and the Wall Street tycoons are the house. And you know how that works. And that's exactly how that works. They've got a built-in Well, they do. They have a built-in advantage. We're going to stop for news coming up at the top of the hour. You're listening to the Guy James Show here in the Head On Radio Network, so don't go away. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers gave GOP Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin she deserved at a Republican fundraiser in Pittsburgh. Jesse Russell has the story.
The United Steelworkers joined with several other unions and drive home the message that Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin doesn't represent union workers, even if her husband Todd is a card-carrying union member. The VP pick has used her husband's steelworker membership to try and win over blue-collar workers that may traditionally be less inclined to vote for a Republican. Palin was in Pittsburgh on Friday for a $1,000 per plate fundraiser, and the steelworkers said they led the march from their office to the Weston Convention Center so she could meet the union that represents her husband.
We think it's kind of ironic that although she and Todd run around the country bragging about being steelworkers and about their great union benefits,
the march that was estimated to number between 200 and 400 was also has spent very little time, if any, speaking about issues in families, such as family leave and child care. They also wanted to remind John McCain seeks to privatize Social Security, which signs deals that would export jobs, and wants to tax employer-provided health care.
The machinist's president, Tom Buffenbarger, is willing to join the talks of the Boeing strike if he's needed. Talks began Sunday for the first time since the 27-on strike at Boeing. The strike has shut down Boeing aircraft production. The union says so far the strike has cost Boeing more than $3.7 million a day in lost sales. Buffenbarger says the union will end the strike. Issues include job security, health care. Economist Dean Baker says the U.S. will get through the financial crisis, but there's plenty of economic trouble to wade through before things rebound.
My expectation is we will get through the immediate financial crisis. There will be more bank failures, or that would be a lot of very bad news coming from the financial sector, but we will get through that. Now, we're still going to have a very serious recession. We have to switch from a situation where we were at a near zero savings rate to a situation where we have a normal savings rate, somewhere around 8% household income.
Baker says if people begin to save more, they will consume less, and that will be a difficult but necessary economic adjustment. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sound, night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music-related wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sound's dedication in classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your eShearsMusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Thanks for lending an ear. He's practicing the politics of the past. Attacks on Barack Obama, not true. False. Baloney. The low road. Baseless. John McCain. Same old politics. Same failed policies. Barack Obama supports a $1,000 middle class tax cut. An energy plan that takes on oil companies, develops alternative fuels, and breaks the grip of foreign oil. That's change we can believe in.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life, you hear me? It's my creation.
So this
this was fun.
You're going to be it.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this good. We got problems.
Any questions before we proceed?
You got
6, 5, 3, 2, 1.
What your country can do for you, I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the Guy James Show today on the Head On Radio Network. Lots going on, eh? We've got another debate, if you want to call them that. What do you think? Will John McCain have the cojones? Or a story. It's not really an incident. It's a story. Will he have the gonads to go ahead and do that tomorrow? Do you think? How? that he. If he does, I say that's the end. Absolutely the end of me. End of him campaign. If he does that, that will put the dead campaign. If he does that tomorrow evening, there's no my mind. And so, therefore, I hope that he does. I really hope that he does. Speaking of the electoral process, we were going to talk about that a little earlier. It's looking very bleak for the McCain people right now. Just about as bad as it gets here. Let me call this up here. I had a couple of them I was looking at. They've got to be feeling very, very bad in the McCain campaign at the moment. Looking at this, well, what do you know? It won't come up right now. Must be a zillion people looking at it. Looking at this Politico map, for one thing, they now have Indiana as a lead for McCain. They now have Virginia and North Carolina with a lead for Obama. They have Florida with a lead for Obama. Missouri with a lead for Wisconsin, a lead for Obama. Nevada, New Mexico. And, of course, in the camp we have Washington, Oregon, Maine, New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, where? Maryland, New York, Vermont, California. It's got to be really stunning to the McCain people now and see North Carolina and Missouri being put in the Obama campaign. That would make the electoral vote right now, if the election were held today, that would make it 364 to 174. 364 to 174, and we still believe that states like Indiana might be able to swing. Might be able to swing. Georgia is just leaning right now. Georgia, can you imagine? So we've got a very interesting story on hand here with this Electoral College map. Let me look at the other one that I look at just about every day as well. Over at Electoral, they have Florida. They have West Virginia down to a one is hard to believe. They have West Virginia with a weak Democratic lead. Ohio with the lead. Indiana, barely GOP with the lead. So, this one, see where the total is on this one. This one has a 7. Obama, 1 in. And in the Senate races, if the election were held, 9, and the GOP 41, Democrats getting 247, and the GOP 1 good at the moment. No question, things are looking good at the moment. It's going to be interesting to see if these leads hold up. Several of these swing states have gone back and forth, and they could again. But what we see right now, what we have in front of us right now, this looks extremely good for Barack Obama. Don't give up the fight. Stay on it. It's something you can't give up on ever, right down to the last day. But I don't think it's going to be all that close this time around. I really, really do not think it's going to be all that close. In fact, a great many of you last week, Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chat, the banking. I've got sense to that, and people ask for more, so I'm going to do that right now. I'm going to play a very lengthy piece of Franklin Roosevelt on top and how people were trying to put it in danger even back then. Yes, this is nothing new. So Franklin Roosevelt on Social Security. This is long, but it's interesting, and don't forget, it is by one of the great men, for my money, in the history of the world. There is no doubt in my mind, none at all, that this country wouldn't even be close to where it is today. It's hard for me to imagine that it would even be the country that it is today without one Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Last Thursday, I described in details everyone at MITS, nation, for the many messages which have come to me after that physically impossible to answer individually, I take of saying thank you. Tonight, sitting at my desk in my first radio report to the people in my term of office, I'm reminded of that evening in Seoul when I made my first radio report to. We were then in the midst of the great banking crisis. Soon after Congress, we asked the nation to turn over all of its held gold, dollar for dollar, to the government of the United States. It proves how right that policy was. Almost 2 years later, it came before the Supreme Court. Its constitutionality was upheld only by a 5-4 vote. The change of one vote would have thrown all the affairs of this great nation back into hopeless chaos. In effect, four justices ruled that the right under a private contract to exact a pound of flesh was more sacred than the main objectives of the Constitution to establish an enduring nation. In 1933, you and I knew that we must never let our economic system get completely out of joint again, that of another Great Depression. We also became clear the only way to avoid a repetition of those dark days was to have prevent and to cure the abuses and policies which had thrown that system out of joint. The program of remedying those abuses and inequalities give balance and stability to our economic system to make it bar causes of 1929. Today, we are only part way through that program and recover point where the dangers of 1929 are again becoming possible. Not this week or month, within a year or two. National laws are needed to complete that program. Individual or local or state effort alone cannot protect us in 1937 any better than 10 years ago. It will take time and plenty of time to work out our remedies administratively, even after legislation is passed. To complete our program of protection in time, therefore, we cannot delay one moment in making certain that our national government has power to carry through. 4 years ago, action did not come until the 11th hour. It was almost too late. If we learned anything from the Depression, we will not allow ourselves to run around in new circle debate, always postponing the day of... The American people have learned from the Depression. No elections, an overwhelming majority a mandate that the Congress and the President begin the task, not after long years of debate. The courts, however, have cast doubts on the to protect us against catastrophe by merely our modern social and economic conditions. A crisis in our ability to proceed with that. It is a quiet crisis. There are no lines of defense. But to the far-sighted, it is past possibilities of injury to America. I want to talk with you very simply tonight about the need for present action in this crisis, the need to meet the unanswered challenge of one-third of a nation ill-nourished, ill-clad, ill-housed. Last Thursday, I described the American form of government as a three-horse team provided by the Constitution to the American people, so that their field might be plowed. The three horses are, of course, the three branches of government, the Congress, two of the horses, the Congress, are pulling in unison today. The third, those who have intimated that the President of the States is trying to drive that team, overlook that the President as chief executive is himself one of the three horses. It is the American people in the driver's seat. It is the American people who want the furrow plowed. It is the American people who want the third horse to pull in unit of the other two. I hope that you have reread the United States in these past few weeks. It ought to be read again and again. It is an easy when you remember that it was called into being because the Articles of Confederation, under which the original 13 states tried to operate after the Revolution, showed the need of a national government with power enough to handle national problems. In its preamble, the Constitution states that it was intended to form a more perfect union and promote the general welfare. And the powers given to the Congress to carry out those purposes can best be described by saying that they were all the powers needed to meet each and every problem which then had a national character and which could not be met by merely local action. Framers of the Constitution went further, having in that in succeeding generations many other problems then undreamed of, no problems, they gave to the Congress the ample levy taxes and provide for the common and general welfare of the United States. I honestly believe to have been the clear purpose of the patriots who wrote a federal constitution with national power intended as to form a more perfect union for ourselves. For nearly 20-year conflict between the Congress and the court, then in 1803, Congress passed a statute which the court said violated an express provision of the Constitution. The court claimed the power to declare it unconstitutional and did so declare it. But a little later, the court itself admitted that it was an extraordinary power to exercise, and through Mr. Justice Washington, laid down this limitation upon it. He said, "It is but a decent respect due to the wisdom, the integrity, and the patriotism of the legislative body by which any law is passed, to presume in favor of validity until its violation of the Constitution is proved all reasonable doubt." Movement for social and economic progress through the court has more and more often and more power to veto laws passed by the state legislatures in complete disregard of which I have just read. In the letter, the sound rule of giving statutes the benefit of has been cast aside. The court acting not as a judicial body, but as a policy. When the Congress has sought to stabilize, to improve the conditions of labor, to safeguard, to protect our national resources, and in many other ways to serve our clearly national needs, the majority of the court has been assuming the power to pass on the wisdom of these acts of the Congress and to approve or disapprove the public policy written into these laws. That is not only my accusation. It is the accusation of most distinguished justices of the present Supreme Court. I have not the time to quote to you all the language used by dissenting justices in many of these cases. But in the case holding the railroad unconstitutional, for instance, Chief Justice Finn, that the majority opinion was a defound principle and placed an unwarranted limitation, and three other justices in the case holding the AAA, Justice Stone said of the majority opinion, tortured construction of the Constitution, and two other with it. In the case holding the New York minimum law unconstitutional, Justice Stone said that the majority Constitution, their own personal predilections, and that if the legislative power is not choose the methods of solving the problems of subsistence and health of large numbers in the community, then government is to be rendered impotent. And two other justices agreed with him. In the face of these dissenting opinions, there is no basis for the claim made by some members of the court that something in the Constitution has compelled them regretfully to thwart the will of the people. In the face of such dissenting opinions, it is perfectly clear that, as Chief Justice Hughes has said, we are under a Constitution, but the Constitution is what the judges say it is. The court, in addition to the proper use of its judicial, has improperly set itself up as a third house of the Congress legislature, as one of the justices has called it, reading into the Constitution words and implications which are and which were never intended to be. We have therefore reached the point as a nation to save the Constitution from the court, and that we must find a way to take from the Supreme Court to the Constitution itself, court, which will do justice and not over it. In our court, we want a government of laws and not of men. I want, as all Americans want, an independent judge by the framers of the Constitution. That means that will enforce the Constitution as written in the Constitution by the arbitrary and judicial power. But, in other words, it does not mean a judiciandum that it can deny the existence of facts. How then could we proceed to perform the mandate given us? It was said in last year's Democratic platform, and here are the words, if these problems cannot be effectively solved within the Constitution, we shall seek such clarifying amendments as will assure the power to adequately to regulate commerce, protect public health, and safeguard economic security. In other words, amendment only if every other possible legislation were to fail. When I commenced the problem squarely before me, I came by a elimination to the conclusion that short of amendments, the only clearly constitutional and would at the same time carry out other much-needed reforms was to infuse new oil our courts. We must have men worthy and equipped to carry out impartial justice. But we must have judges who will bring to the courts a fair sense of the Constitution. Judges who will retain the judicial functions of a court and reject the legislative powers which the courts have today assumed. It is well for us to remember that in 45 out of the 48 states of the Union, judges are chosen not for life, but for a period of years. In many states, judges must retire at the age of 70. Congress has provided financial security by offering life pensions at full pay for federal law courts who are willing to retire at 70. In court justices, that pension is $20 a year. But all appointed can, if they choose, this for life, no matter how old they may. What is my proposal? Simply this. Whenever a judge or justice of any federal court has reached the age of 70 and does not avail himself of the opportunity to retire on a pension, a new member shall be appointed by the president then in office with the approval, as required by the Constitution, of the Senate of the United States. That plan has two chief purposes. By bringing into the judicial system a steady and continuing stream of new, I hope first to make the administration of all federal justice from the bottom to the top less costly. Secondly, to bring to the decision of social and economic problems younger men who have had personal experience and contact with modern facts and circumstances under which average men have to live and work. This plan will save our national constitution from hardening of the judicial arteries. The number of judges to be appointed will depend wholly on the decision of present plus 70 or those who would subsequently reach the... If, for instance, any one of the Supreme Court now over the age of 70 under the plan, no additional plea created. Consequently, although the never... There may be only 14 or 12, and there may be only 9. Novel or radical about this idea, it seeks the federal bench in full vigor. It has been discussed and approved authority ever since a similar proposal to representatives in 1869 at 70. Because the laws and the practice of the civil service, the regulations of the Navy, and the rules of many of our universities and of almost every enterprise commonly fix the retirement age at 70 years or less. The statute would apply to all the courts in the federal system. There is general approval so far as the lower federal courts are concerned. The plan has met opposition only so far as the Supreme Court of the United States itself is concerned. But, my friends, if such a plan is good for the lower, be equally good for the highest court, from which no appeal. Those opposing this house prejudice and fear by trying to pack the Supreme Court and will be established. What do they mean by packing the Supreme Court? With a bluntness that will end honest misunderstanding of my purposes. Is packing the court, it is charged that I on the bench spineless puppets who would disregard the law, specific cases as I wish them to be decided, this answer, that no president fit for his office would appoint, and no Senate of honorable men fit for their office would, that kind of appointees to the Supreme Court. That phrase, the charge is made that I would appoint and the Senate would confirm justices worthy to sit beside present members of the court who understand modern conditions, that I will appoint justices who will not undertake to override the judgment of the Congress on legislative policy, that I will appoint justices who will act as justices and not as legislators, if the appointment of such justices can be called packing the court, then I say that I, and with me the vast majority of the America, doing just that thing now. Is it a dangerous precedent for the Congress? The Congress has always had, will have, that power. The number of justices has been four in the administration of John Adams, Jefferson, both of them signers of the Declaration of Independence, Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, and Ulysses S. Grant. I suggest only the addition of justices to the bench, a defined principle relating to a clearly defined age limit. Fundamentally, if in the future America should elect to refrain from abuse of original usages, democracy will have failed far of any kind of precedent consist. We think it so much in the public interest to maintain a vigorous judiciary that we encourage the retirement of elderly judges by offering them a life pension at full salary. Why then should we leave the fulfillment of this public policy to chance, or make it dependent upon the desire or prejudice of any individual justice? It is the clear intention of our public policy to provide for a constant flow of new and younger blood into the judiciary. Normally, every president appoints a large number of district and circuit few members of the Supreme Court. Until my first president of the United States in our history, one member of the Supreme Court, President Taft appointed the Chief Justice, President Wilson, three, President Harding, four, including a Chief Justice, President Hoover, three, including a Chief Justice. Such a succession of appointments should have as to age, but chance and action of individuals to leave the Supreme Bench have now given us a five justices will be over 75 years of next June, and one over 70, thus has been defeated. Propose that we establish by law an balanced court in the future. I propose that hereafter, when a judge reaches the age of 70, a new and younger judge shall be added to the court automatically. In this way, I propose to enforce a sound public policy by law. Instead of leaving the composition of our federal courts, including the highest, to be determined by chance or the personal decision of individuals. If such a law as I propose is regarded as establishing a new precedent, is it not a most desirable precedent? Like all lawyers, like all Americans, I read controversy. But the welfare of the United States, and indeed of the Constitution itself, is what we all must. Our difficulty with the court today is not from the court as an institution, but from human beings, that we cannot yield our constitutional despot to the personal judgment of a few men who, being fearful of the court, deny us the necessary means of dealing with the kind of mine is no attack on the court. Restore the court to its rightful and historic place, in and to have it resume its high task on the Constitution, a system of living. The court itself can best undo what the court has done. I have thus explained to you the reasons that lie behind our efforts to secure results by legislation within the Constitution. I hope that thereby the difficult process of constitutional amendment may be rendered unnecessary. But let us examine that process. There are many types of amendment proposed. Each one is radically different from the other. But there is no substantial in the Congress or outside the Congress were agree amendments. I believe that it would take for years to get substantial agreement upon the type and language. It would take months and years thereafter to get a two-thirds majority in favor of that amendment in Congress. Then would come the long course of litigation by three-quarters of all the states, any powerful economic interests, or the leaders of any political party have had reason to oppose as ever anything like a reasonable time. And remember, 5% of the voting population, even though the 35 states with none of the population are in favor of it. A very newspaper publishers and chambers of commerce and bar associations and manufacturers associations who are trying to give the impression today that they really do want a constitutional amendment would be the very first to exclaim as soon as an amendment was proposed, "Oh, I was for an amendment, all right. But this amendment that you've proposed is not the kind of an amendment that I was thinking about. And so I am going to spend my time, my efforts, and my money to block this amendment, although I to get some other kind of an amendment ratified." Two groups oppose my plan on the ground that they favor. The first includes those who fundamentally object to economic legislation along modern lines. This is the same recent campaign tried to block the mandate. And the strategy of that last stand is to suggest the process of amendment in order to kill away the legislation demanded by the mandate. I say, I do not think you will be wrong to fool the American people as to your purposes. The group is composed of those who honestly believe the amendment best and who would be willing to support a reasonable amendment. To them I say, we cannot rely on an amendment as the immediate or only answer to our present difficulties. When the time comes for action, you will find that many of those who pretend to support you will sabotage any constructive amendment which is proposed. Look at these stores. When before have you found them really at your side in your fights for progress? One thing more. Even if an amendment were passed, the years to come it were to be ratified, its meaning of justices who would be sitting on the Supreme Court for an amendment like the rest of the Constitution is what it is, rather than what its framers or you might is. This proposal of mine will not infringe in the slightest on the civil or religious liberties. So, dear, my record as governor and as president proves my devotion to those liberties.
first a kiss and a glass of wine. Just one more dance. My, someday you'll know how hard I tried and how much you meant to me. Your world may use well your time. Be part of something good. Keep good behind. The curtain falls. I take my bow. That's how it's meant to be. It's your world now. Oh, it's your
world now. Ah, yes, it's your world now, and seems to me that's kind of what we're up to right now, isn't it? Trying to make sure that it stays ours and not fall into the hands of a few. That it should be the country of the people, by the people, and for the people instead of a few. That's what this election is all about this time. More so, I can't think of a time when our freedoms, our liberties, our financial well-being, our securities that are important to the American people, I cannot think of a time important in history than right now. That's why. And yes, I am confident about this election. I'm feeling we cannot let up, despite our confidence, despite my confidence. I don't know how confident you hear from more and more people that they have great confidence in a victory. I feel that way as well. But we still got to keep, as they used to say, the pedal to the metal until it's over. And I think one thing that we can probably on November the 5th, when it is announced that, and I hope it's announced that we don't have any hanky-panky going on that causes another one. But when it is finally admitted and conceded by the McCain-Palin campaign that indeed Barack Obama fifth, I hope that America, all of America, will have the good sense to tone it down, to lick their wounds, their political wounds, and get over it. And for a change, get behind a new president that gives this country some hope. Frankly, I do feel very hopeful. And I know we're in a real, real, very, very tough time. And many people are suffering. Financially, health, suffering. But I am hopeful the administration can bring hope, can bring some answers to the problems we now have back on the right track. This is, after all, America, and the troubles we have. I believe that we can get back to what we could be and resume the direction that the Democratic Party has taken us forward and upward for some of this ugly thing that we've got now, the situation. So I hope all this hatred can be put aside. I earnestly hope that. I sure do. Ace, if you'd like to join us here on the program today, kind of a laid-back show today. I've gotten a lot of email, one in particular from assuming that said he didn't care to hear anything more from me about the economy because I didn't know my proverbial ass from a hole in the ground, my opinions on it. Well, I am allowed to give my opinions on it, you see. Not only did I give a lot of facts opinions on it, and yes, I do know something about the economy. And yes, I do know enough for me anyway about economics and how this country works economically. So, why turn the thing off, okay? That's all. And anyway, we had a long discussion talking about derivatives, and a lot of people really don't understand derivatives. And to break it down, and of course, the number one reason. That things have gone south economically, and probably the number one reason for all the financial. It's my opinion that what really caused this the derivatives, and the best way to explain it is, and it's fairly difficult. Suppose you've got a neighbor whose house, say, and that he's got a $400,000 mortgage held by the bank. Nothing unusual about that. He doesn't owe you any money and neighbors and acquaintances. So I sell you a piece of paper for $5,000 that says I will pay you the value of the neighbor's house if he defaults on his mortgage. So really and truly, what you've bought for your $5,000 is a derivative. And why do you care if he defaults? You really don't. And what do you lose if he defaults? You don't lose anything. And defaulting? Nothing. So who gains by this silly-ass derivative? We both do. I gained the $5,000 by selling it to you in the first place. All it cost me was a few dollars, some legalese mumbo-jumbo. And you gain because you now have a secured debt obligation. That's what it's called. And it is secured because it's tied to the value of your neighbor's house, which you do not own, and upon which now and never will have any real financial claim. Base value of this secured debt obligation is fixed, so you can show it to a banker, and this is exactly what's been going on all year, and borrow a piece of paper as collateral. And the bank secured loan for however much they loaned you on this thing. So now we've got the $400,000 mortgage, the $500,000 bank loan, all of it secured by this one $500,000 house. And when you add that all up, that's and it's riding on the homeowner paying the mortgage. And I've only sold one derivative against it. There's no limit to sell against that house. That is why the derivatives market is estimated to be over $50 trillion. Every penny of it is play money. All of it. Derivatives are very simply financial instruments created for the sole purpose of making money, selling the instruments to people who are stupid enough or crooked enough to buy them. That's all that's involved, is being crooked or stupid. So your neighbor defaulting on his mortgage is today's crisis. Forget all that talk about the how the government can pay off his mortgage is not the problem. The problem is your derivative that you obtained based on it. Now, I have to pay you that $500,000. Can't do it. And since the derivative is the loan has become an unsecured loan, and your bank is freaking out about unsecured debt on the books, and as a result of all that, to obey the banking laws and stop lending. So your neighbor triggered the derivative. And your bank loan actually caused the problem. Nobody looked at your finances until your neighbor defaulted. That was the trigger. And then they looked at your books and they looked at mine, and as a result of his default, and they saw those finances were rotten and corrupt to the core, and then it all hits the fan, which is now what's happened. And yet politicians of both parties
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I believe I'm talking to America. Maybe I'm not so sure. I think that those of you in Nebraska and Kansas are in what Sarah Palin calls the real America. But, you know, if you're listening to me from New York or California or Vermont, you're not. You're not real America. You're not pro-American. You are anti-American. You are a terrorist. Now, I'm not just saying this. I mean, this is what Sarah Palin has been saying. And it makes me ask, is this what most right-wingers think? Not that we have disagreements. You know, they believe in trickle-down economics. We Democrats believe that everybody should have a chance in America, and in fact, that it helps the economy. I'm not talking about differences on policy. I'm talking about the fact that this division into red and blue states seems to be all that the Republican Party has left. And we know they ran on God's gaze and guns in 2004. Do Republicans really believe that those of us that don't support them are not real Americans.